Support this podcast via our Patreon and get more writerly goodness. Visit patreon.com/nanocast to join up.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of 24 books, 34 short stories, and countless articles and scripts and essays, and I am your guide on this quest to raise your output to pulp speed levels and to explore the cracks and crevices of business and craft in the writing life. Welcome to The Questions, episode 185. Today we have a question from Dan the Art Man, who has been a listener to my fiction podcast for a long time, and I'm so pleased that you've found the nonfiction podcast, Dan. It's good to see you around these parts. And, hey, I love your name. Don't know why, but I do. Today Dan asks, I'm still struggling with Heinlein's rule, do not rewrite unless to editorial demand. I feel like I've improved many stories by going back and making fixes. Does rewriting just mean going back through and wordsmithing every sentence? Making story fixes is not breaking this rule, is it? Once your first draft is done, what's your process? I would love it if you could kind of define what you think Heinlein, Dean Wesley Smith, and you mean when you suggest not to rewrite. I think you mentioned you do cycling like Dean Wesley Smith does. Either way, I'd love to hear more about your process of getting a manuscript ready for beta readers. Well, Dan, do not rewrite unless to editorial demand. The first thing that this rule is supposed to do is to stop the impulse to keep tinkering with a story. We've all got that impulse, and it's really bad early on when we are feeling fairly insecure about our writing abilities. It never quite completely goes away, but the more confident you are, the less you're finding yourself wishing you could go back and make it perfect. The impulse to go back and make it perfect is death to creativity. It's death to creativity for a couple of reasons. First of all, it traps you in a certain story, and you're never going to grow creatively if you're telling the same story over and over again. In order to grow, you need to be moving around like a grazing animal, searching out a healthy diet on the prairie. You can't just be eating alfalfa. You also need to be eating prairie turnips and other stuff like that, so that you get a good balanced diet. Well, your practice as a writer is like that. You don't want to tell just one story. You don't even want to stick to just one genre, not really. And if you do, you want to tell a variety of sorts of stories in that genre so that you're practicing different aspects of craft. If you keep telling the same story, you may get really good at that kind of story, but you're going to be weak on things that that kind of story doesn't demand as a necessary condition for telling that story. And because of that, after a while, your stories will start to feel pretty thin to your readers. A really good writer develops different storytelling muscles every time they go to tell a story. In this book, they're working on characterization, or maybe characterization of a particular kind of character they've never touched before. In that book, they're working on cliffhangering. In this book, they're working on character voice and getting the character voice into the narration without pushing it so far that it's not clear that it's a book by the same writer. And in the next book, they might be working on plot twists and twist endings. There's all sorts of things. There's an infinite number of things you can be working on every time you sit down to write a story. Going back and rewriting a story to get it right, to get it perfect, it assumes a sort of Platonistic way of thinking. And if you haven't read Plato, you really should. It's difficult reading, but it's foundational to the way a lot of people think in Western culture. In fact, the argument between Plato and Aristotle is the defining argument of Western culture. Every philosopher since then has been either arguing against Plato or arguing against Aristotle, with the exception of Friedrich Nietzsche, who argued against both of them. That's a much longer conversation. Anyway, Plato had this parable of the cave he used to explain his view of reality. Plato said, humanity is like a man chained in a cave to a stalagmite, watching the wall where plays out the shadows of people walking by outside the cave. And as far as the man who is chained to the stalagmite is concerned, what plays out on the wall is the real world, being unaware completely of the genuine real world behind him. The notion is that off in some eternal space, some heavenly space somewhere, there are perfect kinds of everything. There is a perfect cube. There is a perfect chair. There is a perfect dog. There is a perfect human. There is a perfect emotion. Everything you can name has a perfect form in what's called Platonic space, an epitome. Epitome being an epitome, which is a perfect example of a book. So because you're the person stuck in the cave, all of the people and dogs and chairs and emotions and named things you run into in everyday life are just shadowy and imperfect reflections of the perfect form that exists in Platonic space. Humans are natural Platonists. We naturally think of things this way, and it's not just humans. Dogs are natural Platonists. I have observed some incredible behaviors in the dog that I have been training and raising over the last year. Things like if she finds a shred of a rope toy that has been thrown away, she will bring that shred of rope toy to me and ask me to play with it, even though it's completely unsuited to the job of playing. She will want to play with that bit of rope because in her mind it is substantially the same as the big rope it came from. Everything about the rope is an expression of the quintessence of that rope, and that rope is what she wants. So dogs are natural Platonists. I will bet you that Platonic thinking is rooted so deep in the mammalian consciousness that every mammal that is capable of symbolic thought, which is most mammals, is a Platonist. And beginning writers, like dogs and like everybody else, have this Platonic urge. They have a book in their head, a story in their head that they want to tell perfectly, and they have an image of how that perfection looks. And attempting to pursue that perfection will kill your creative career because that perfection is an illusion. Even if Plato might have been right about the spiritual world, and that's not an issue worth getting into on this podcast, when it comes to things like creativity or chairs, Plato was wrong. Creativity is an emergent process, very like evolution. It is conditioned by risk and feedback. You know, you take a risk, you put an idea on paper, and as you develop the idea, some things of it seem to you to be working well enough to continue with it, others don't seem to be working well enough, so you leave them by the wayside, and you sort of chart your course through this unknown and unknowable landscape along this thread of the story you're spinning. When you get to the end of that thread and the story is done, you have created something that is complete. Now, when you look back at it and you say, oh, it's not good enough, what you're doing is you're comparing it against the Platonic form that's in your head. And Heinlein's third rule we're talking about is all about learning to treat your writing like the business that it is. And in a business, you do not go back and fix a product that you've made unless the customer is telling you that they want changes. Editorial demand means customer demand. In Heinlein's day, the editor was the person that wrote the checks. So if someone is offering to write you a check for a story, and they say, this is great, and I love it, and I want to buy it, but it doesn't quite fit the anthology I'm putting together, could you add in a little moment where this happens so that we can squeeze it in? Or could you take out this patch of rough language because it's not going to play well with the market that we're pitching the anthology towards? Those are the kinds of changes you make to editorial demand. And then, of course, there was Harlan Ellison's addendum, only if you agree. It's perfectly acceptable to say, no, I don't want to make that change. I'm going to go my own way and not join this anthology or this magazine or whatever it is. Now, that's the basic background behind the rule and why Heinlein posited the rule in the way he did. Now, there's more extreme versions of it where you don't go back and touch anything ever. And that would be kind of what Dean does, what Dean Wesley Smith does. I've gotten to know him very well over the last few years, and he's adamant. He never goes back and changes things. He's got his process. He is so intensely self-critical as a person that if he allows himself to go back, he's going to fall right into that Platonistic trap, and he's never going to climb out. And he knows that, so he limits himself. He just absolutely does not let himself go back. He's someone who doesn't like his own writing, and when you don't like your own writing, you get hypercritical and you try to make it into something that you like. Well, that's another version of the Platonist's trap. So that's sort of the hard end of the spectrum. And there's various softer ways to approach it, some that you'll find espoused by people like Robert J. Sawyer and whatnot, who are all about, yeah, go back and fix it, but, you know, don't spend a lot of time fixing it, who follow sort of the spirit of the law without getting worried too much about the letter of the law, or who try to approach things that way. Making story fixes is one of those squishy areas that you want to be careful of. There's things you might want to fix and that you might legitimately want to fix without breaking Heinlein's rule. Things like a major continuity error. Things like you've got the murderer is revealed at the end, but it turns out that they're not in the right place to commit the murder, and you've got other things in the story that are going against it. Things like that you absolutely want to fix. And those are the kinds of things that your first reader is supposed to help you with. When Dean says that he asks his first reader, is there anything in here that will embarrass me? That's the kind of stuff he means. Is there anything that will make him look like a sloppy writer? That's something Dean cares very much about. And I do too. I think that's really important. When a reader buys your story, they're buying the implicit promise that what they're about to read is going to match the expectations that your packaging has set up for them. So if you've packaged it as a science fiction story and it turns out to be just a ramble of random adventures through a vaguely science fictional land but doesn't have a story in it, a lot of them are going to feel cheated. If you package it as a mystery story and the mystery doesn't make sense at the end, a lot of them are going to feel cheated. So that part is really important. And going back and doing those kinds of story fixes, definitely, you definitely want to do those. That the story isn't done until the story is done. It's not when you type the end that it's done. The story is done when the story is told completely. It's very important for those of us who write out of order. Some of us write the final scene first. I've done that on a few books. But you do want to be careful, because when you talk about story fixes in a general sense, you're opening up a kind of a rhetorically squishy room where you can say, well, yeah, I really want to add this second storyline in, even though I've kind of done with the story, or maybe I'll combine these two characters and rewrite a substantial part of the novel. That sort of stuff is Hollywood-style rewriting, and that you definitely want to stay away from. It's much better to learn to do that stuff on the fly as you're going, or you're gonna permanently cripple your process. Hollywood-style rewriting does that because in Hollywood, the writer's job is to serve the producer's and the director's needs. In novel writing, the writer's job is to serve the story's needs and the writer's needs. Then, hopefully, also the audience's needs. But you don't write based on what your audience tells you they want. You write based on what you want to tell them, and then you find an audience that wants what you're saying. It's a very important distinction because the audience never knows what it wants until it finds it, and usually when they say they want something and then they get it, they hate it because they've already got a platonic version of that sort of thing in their head that's better than anything you could ever do. So, once my first draft is done, I hand it off to my first reader who reads it through and tells me whether or not it's working. She marks unclear sentences, unclear plot threads, stuff where there's major continuity errors, and those sorts of things all get fixed. Then it goes back to her and to a few other people for proofreading and for general audience intelligence. And the general audience intelligence does not ever induce me to change a book. What I want to know is how they're reacting to this book so I can learn better how to tell a story in the next book. They're also catching other continuity errors that slip through the cracks the first time. They're catching typos. If it's the beta reader, there's things like that. But I do always ask them for an audience reaction, and the audience reaction is to help me better understand how my audience thinks and reacts to the things I do. So in the next book, if I had some clunky problems in this book, I can do better on those points, take different risks, learn more things that way. But I do not ever go back and apply changes based on audience reaction to the book that's currently in the publishing queue. That book is done once the first round of continuity fixes gets done. Then the second round, any obvious continuity fixes and, of course, any typos that are found, those get incorporated back in. The other things get rolled into my mental queue for the next time, and then the book goes to press. And that's how I do it. As far as the cycling, What happens for me is, as I'm writing through, I will write out of order. It depends on the book whether I write mostly straight through or mostly out of order. The complex, multi-threaded books like you get with what used to be called the antithesis progression, those I generally write out of order. The tightly plotted small books, particularly the mysteries, those I write in order because there's an experience of figuring out what's going on along with the main character that I find is really fun and gratifying to write. And so I frequently don't know the solution to the mystery until the solution to the mystery pops up in the mind of the main character, which then sometimes causes problems, continuity problems that I have to go back and fix. But, you know, but as I'm going through a book and something develops, I have a great idea, and that great idea is not something I've laid a foundation for, I make a note to myself. And then once I'm at the end of the scene I'm writing, I go back and look at that note and pop back in the manuscript and figure out where I need to seed things in. Sometimes if it's a minor thing like, oh, I've changed the color of Rachel's eyes, or I'm not sure what color Naya's eyes are, that sort of thing I'll leave till the end and worry about it later because it doesn't actually make a difference to anything. But anything that could make a difference, I will pop back and forth in the manuscript all the time, right in the heat of composition, and make fixes, make tweaks, read through, touch, push things this way and that, kind of like a sculptor does with live clay. And then once the story is done, then the clay goes into the kiln to get fired, and after that point, you don't make changes to it. You know, you can brush the dirt off, you can chip off a couple of corners that weren't properly trimmed, but you don't make changes to it, because at that point you fall into that Platonistic rewriting hell, and you don't want to do that if you want to develop your abilities as a writer. The end that this process seeks, because it is a never-ending process, the end that this process seeks is the ability to sit down and write clean copy and be done with it. You write a story, the story is done, you send it off, it's got almost no continuity problems, it's got whatever level of typos you happen to be prone to, but you sit down, you write a story, it's done, you send it out. You sit down, you write a story, it's done, you send it out. This is the way most writers have worked throughout history. It's basic writing competence. Since the introduction of the word processor, this process has gotten corrupted because the technical ability to go back and change things has opened up the floodgates to our insecurities and to all of the scolds and snobs and critics who like to pretend that sinking a vast amount of time into something is the same as sinking a vast amount of yourself into something. And that's not the case. Frequently, the more time you spend polishing and refining something, the more distance you're creating between yourself and the artwork. The less personal it becomes, the less meaningful it becomes, and the more generic it becomes. Do what Dickens did, what Poe did, what Shakespeare did. Write something as good as you can, with as much of yourself in it as you can. Apply any fixes you need to in order for it to make sense. And then let it go, and apply the lessons you learn from the audience reactions to that story after it's released to your next story. Just like a feedback loop playing basketball, when you're practicing your free throws, if a ball bounces off the rim, you don't take that shot back and then do it again. You try something different with your next shot. Stories are the same way. I hope that helps. That was a great question. It's made for a very long episode. I hope I didn't bore you to death. Thank you very much for writing in, and I'll see you tomorrow. The Everyday Novelist is written and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions. Visit our website at everydaynovelist.com and leave a tip in the tip jar or join the Patreon to support this podcast. The Everyday Novelist is copyright 2016 by J. Daniel Sawyer and Artistic Whispers Productions, Inc., and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Remember that now through December 22nd, you can get a book bundle filled with books on writing, craft, and business and discipline at storybundle.com/nano. 11 books, including one of my own, all dedicated to helping you write better, faster, and manage your business more effectively so that you have more time to write better and faster. Check it out now while there's still time at storybundle.com/nano.